We are working through the seventh sign, or the seventh living parable on the raising of Lazarus. It's the teaching of resurrection by Jesus, and we're about halfway through. We have stopped at the point yesterday where Martha was the one that came out to meet with Jesus outside the home of Mary and Martha because of the concern of the hostility of the Jews. And Martha came to Jesus and asked the same question that would be asked of him two more times, by Mary when she came out and talked with Jesus, and by the Jews: if thou hadst been there, you could have saved him. Martha is now convinced. She's convinced that Jesus has the capacity from his heavenly Father in their closeness that he could really affect the miracle of resurrection at that time if he wanted to, in addition to the long-range common hope and belief in resurrection. So Mary's comforted, as we left off, and she's now ready to return and to move on to a certain extent. Now, in the meantime, Mary comes out from the house. She seeks comfort from Jesus, but along with her trails the Jews that have come out from Jerusalem to help in the mourning process, as was the custom. So here comes Mary, and she asked Jesus the same thing: if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. Now, verse 33, and we're in John 11, represents a convergence, you might say, of circumstances. Mary continues to weep, having just challenged Jesus. The Jews on cue were weeping as well. Jesus felt empathy for Mary, but he felt consternation and irritation, we might conclude, by the hypocritical Jews who would be wailing and carrying on there in his presence. Just a few days earlier, you recall, many of these Jews would have gladly stoned Jesus. So we're told there in 33, then Jesus groaned and was troubled in spirit. Their hypocrisy was getting to Jesus. That's what we might conclude. Now, Rotherham renders verse 33 as, Jesus therefore, when he saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her weeping, was indignant in the spirit and troubled himself. Indignant in the spirit. So out of this scene then, we're told that Jesus wept. He felt great sadness for his beloved sisters. He was sad for the scenario that he was presented with. He would have been sad for Lazarus, but we might conclude that he didn't weep for Lazarus because he was about to raise him. He's touched by our infirmities, is the takeaway. Jesus is not a hard-shelled individual. He is touched by our infirmities. He knows our struggles on a daily basis. He's mindful of all of our personal infirmities. He has a broken heart when we have a broken heart. So next, Jesus cuts to the chase. He says, where have you laid him? Jesus next had to endure the Jews making a similar case in that had he been there sooner, he could have saved Lazarus. Or that perhaps the Jews were lamenting that he didn't have the power to raise Lazarus, secretly hoping that was the case. The Jews then were slipping back into their old form of denial, and Jesus would have been troubled because he knew this was what's going to happen at his cross as well. As they stood beneath him and as they waggled their heads, Martha raised the objection that he stinketh, to which Jesus reminded, if thou wouldst believe, thou shouldst see the glory of God. Now, the fact that the 4 days had gone by this time, Lazarus had started to corrupt. That's the time frame for corruption, or frankly, the rotting of a body. And indeed, this situation would then have leveraged all the more glory to Yahweh for his resurrection and healing. This number four, for 4 days in the grave, has a significance. There were four standards under which the nation of Israel marched. There were four living creatures of Ezekiel's prophecy. There were four carpenters and four chariots of Zechariah's prophecy. There were four living creatures of the apocalypse identified with the four faces of the cherubim. Lazarus typified the multitudinous Christ body that will be resurrected to stand before Christ at the judgment seat. Now, there's an interesting thought here, and that is that Lazarus had started to corrupt, but John, the writer of his gospel, could have more discreetly said, and Lazarus corrupted. But John chose to use the very blunt term that Lazarus stinketh. I'm wondering, could this well describe John's indignation over the hypocritical Jews who were plotting to kill Jesus, who would have stoned him if given half the opportunity, and possibly who would have ultimately exclaimed, "We have no king but Caesar"? What better figure than a rotting Jewish body to portray the sad condition of the religion that the scribes and Pharisees were propagating and keeping at that time? So, how many of you here, by the way, have seen the Garden Tomb in Jerusalem? Got one back there. That's a moving couple, yeah. That's a moving place to sit and reflect upon, is it not? You've got a round stone as a door closure that rolls in a trough, and inside you have the cradles where a body, where multiple bodies could have been laid. So notice here that in this sequence, Jesus acknowledges the glory of God before he calls Lazarus out. So it depicts Jesus' total confidence that this is going to come off without a hitch. It gives further glory to God because he has laid it all on the line, has he not? It was a setup for failure and for ridicule had this not happened. But, of course, it was all for the glory of God. Jesus thanks his Father now in verse 42. And I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people who stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. So we can certainly conclude that Jesus would have been in prayer often that night, moments before, but this verbal prayer was for the benefit of the people, that there would be no mistake of the connection of his power source, and it served to confirm that Jesus was the one again sent by God. So we have Lazarus bound in the typical grave garments of that time, bound hand and foot, bound around the face. Jesus says forcefully, "Loose him and let him go." So try and imagine the dynamics of that scene. The contrast between Lazarus' resurrection and that of Jesus is significant. Lazarus came forth bound. He would die again. He was mortal. He was destined for the grave again. How long he lived after this experience, we don't know. Jesus came forth without his grave clothes. They were found neatly in the sepulcher. Jesus was on his way to immortality and heaven. He wouldn't be going back. The resurrection of Lazarus was a clear look ahead to the resurrection of Jesus, despite the differences. The power of God was revealed to all. Would it be denied, we might conclude, or anyone who observed this miraculous miracle? Could it be denied Jesus then, 12 months later, if he could bring forth this man from the grave? People would have to be coming to that conclusion, that what he was going to be preaching and what would be coming forth with more clarity, especially the very last days of Jesus' life, for those who could make that synapse and get their mind around the fact that he had to die, there should have been no doubt that he wouldn't come forth from the grave. Now we're told that many of the Jews who came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did believed on him. Yet predictably, many of the Jews out of the Jerusalem scene didn't. And they hustled back to Jerusalem to tell the thing. Non-believing Jews under the wicked Caiaphas adjourned a council, set in motion the plan to capture and to kill Jesus. For this man doeth many miracles, and if we let him alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and our nation. They enjoyed a nice little niche there in the Jerusalem scene. Allowed and tolerated by Rome, wealthy, basking in the revenue of the temple, which they had access to, this was about self-preservation, and this is the way they looked at it totally. Jesus, following this, departed into the wilderness. Now, some summary and some takeaways. This parable was framed with the hostile Jews trying to stone Jesus in the previous chapter. And that was in chapter 10. We know that this was in the dead of winter, John tells us in chapter 10, verse 22, and it was at Jerusalem, the feast of the dedication, and it was winter. This was the winter of antagonism and hostility against Jesus. That's the clue that John wants us to take away. The singularly arrogant and wicked Caiaphas is felt to be the one who ramrodded and spearheaded the movement to get and to kill Christ. His countertype is the papacy and the Pope, who will be the ramrod and the spearhead to try and snuff out Christ when he returns the second time. Quoting from Psalm 2, why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. Mary and Martha represent the faithful saints who are alive at Christ's coming. And likewise, Lazarus, out of the same household, will represent those precious saints who have died in the interim and who Jesus regards to as merely asleep, a most comfortable designation. So, in closing this living parable, it's about the second coming of Jesus, the hope of the faithful predicated upon the miracle of resurrection as taught in this parable. So now we're moving into the eighth sign found in John 21, verse 1 to 19. This would conclude the eight signs as John chose to record them. By all means, don't think that this is the extent of Jesus' teaching. You know that you have to go back into the other three Gospels and fill in the gaps. But this forms a backbone as to what Jesus wanted to get across in his teaching. So this again is another lovely picture of the actual Sea of Galilee. And it's much more lush in this picture. And this is what we'll expect in the kingdom age. A lot had happened since the resurrection of Lazarus. The world would have forever been changed. The scheming plans of the Jews and their council had come to fruition in that Jesus had been crucified, but the grave could not hold him. And after 3 days, he lived again. Two angels proclaimed the good news to Mary Magdalene that day, along with Mary, his mother. And later on that evening, Jesus would appear to his disciples. In John 20, verse 19, this then was the second time Jesus would appear to his disciples after his resurrection. And we have the third time that Jesus appears to his disciples is at the Sea of Galilee, where this parable takes place. Now, this last sign has a dual fulfillment to it in that it represents the triumph of saints during the next 2,000 years, but it also represents the bounty that will be received in the kingdom age as well, that will be found in this net. Now, as this unfolds, and while I'm thinking of it, we'll see how the net was full of 153 fish, and it was so many that the apostles couldn't get it into the boat. So we're told that a smaller boat came from the near shore with the other disciples in it, who would no doubt have snagged onto the net and helped to pull it to shore. I suggest for your consideration that the main boat towing the net represents those caught in the gospel net, described as great, great fish, and that the smaller boat represents the bounty or the harvest taken out of the millennial age, where there will be less population left in the earth after the wars of Armageddon, and there will be perhaps less of those who would come into salvation and be regarded amongst the total saved of Christ. That's strictly a Don musing for your consideration. Now, there were seven disciples present for this third meeting at the Sea of Galilee. They traveled together. They represent the complete number of the covenant redeemed, received by Christ at the judgment seat. Their number would be greatly expanded in the kingdom, and we might say this is typified by the seven shepherds and the eight principal men as referenced in Micah 5. So their number would be greatly expanded, i.e. through the sons of Melchizedek in their immortality. Now we have Peter in this scene, and he is a picture of agitation. He is agitated from his three denials of Christ. This would weigh on all of our consciences, wouldn't it? After he, in essence, said, I go up and I go a-fishing. So we can say, what's going on here? After 3 years of being with his Lord, he decides to, in essence, return to the world. The other six disciples, interestingly enough, followed his lead. So why did Peter do this? Why return to his old lifestyle? He was being trained to become a fisher of men, and he returned to be a fisher of fish. Well, we might cut him a little slack, because we know that when ecclesial and spiritual problems become a little overwhelming, or maybe our workload becomes a little overwhelming, or familiar things become a little overwhelming, it's okay to return to a familiar pursuit, to pick up the golf clubs, to take a breather, to try to clear the head, as we say. So this, I think, is probably what Peter was trying to do here. This is all right as long as we never forget where it's at. Follow me and I will make you fishers of men, had been told us in Matthew 5. And here they return to become fishers of fish. We might say, predictably, they caught no fish. And by reverting to the world, that's really how it is. They went out on the Sea of Nations and they were going to catch fish, but they caught nothing. So there was a reason for all this, of course. There was no divine help for them to do this. It's impossible to bring forth fruit to the glory of God without the blessing and favor of Yahweh beforehand. So this was taught the apostles who labored all night without success. They were about to be launched on their respective teaching campaigns to launch the apostolic movement. Jesus would be gone before long. They had to be taught that they needed to rely upon him constantly if they were ever going to be successful. Now, there was another thing that was bothering Peter, and that was the fact that an angel had specifically said that Peter needed to go into Galilee to see Christ. And this is recorded back in Mark 16:7. Now, that would make us all a little bit nervous in light of the fact that if we had denied Christ three times. But go your way, tell his disciples and Peter that he goeth before you into Galilee. There shall you see him as he said unto you. So Peter would be rolling this around, you can imagine, as to what the Lord had in for him. Now, early dawn crept over the hills. The apostles were able to see a figure on the near shore. And they heard a voice, "My children, have you any fish?" So the Greek word here for children is paiden, and it's rendered a little or young child. Now, why would Jesus address his adult disciples as a little or a young child? Well, it was because of their actions, was it not? They had shown their immaturity. Instead of waiting patiently for him at presumably a designated place, they became diverted and they followed the impetuous Peter and they went fishing. So this gentle rebuke would be later appreciated by the apostles. And in the AV, the Greek word for meat, "Brethren, do you have any fish?" is rendered meat in some versions, is better rendered cooked fish. "Brethren, do you have any cooked fish?" So additionally, Jesus was further tweaking them just a little bit. In essence, he was saying, have you caught, cooked, and eaten a meal yet? Well, the answer was a blunt no. So then Jesus instructs them to cast your net on the right side of the ship, and you shall find. So this then takes our mind back to the judgment process, does it not? Does it not? The net was immediately filled with 153 fish, so that it couldn't be hauled in the ship and managed by the seven apostles in that boat. Other disciples then, we're told, came from shore in a smaller boat, so that between the two of them they could drag this boat to shore. And this then is where I injected the thought that the other smaller boat would represent a gospel haul, yet smaller, from the kingdom age. Now, all of the fish were described as great or exceptional fish. This would be in contrast to the fish in a similar parable back in Matthew 13, verse 47 to 49, where some were described as good and some were described as bad, fit only to be cast back into the sea. So this spoke directly to the judgment and the failure of some to be found acceptable. So John, by his spiritual perception, recognized Jesus on the shore, and he told Peter, "It is the Lord. It is the Lord." So Peter girds himself. As we're told, he was apparently fishing naked, and he jumped into the sea out of appreciation and swam to Christ. Now, this number, 153 fish, then represents the vast quantity of brethren who would hear the truth over the centuries, who would be drawn out of the sea of nations from the foundation of the world to be numbered among the redeemed in the day of judgment. 153 is a strange number. You look at it and it doesn't ring any bells. You can't readily see any types out of it. So it has to be kind of beaten up a little bit mathematically to come up with something. Topically, we can just say it represents those whom Jesus knows secretly, who will be saved and who will be blessed with the gift of immortality. This is the number Jesus holds figuratively in his mind. Needless to say, the saved and the brethren will be as the stars of the heaven and the sands of the seashore, and it won't be 153. We'll look at that number and break it down in a minute here. Now, some commentaries like to play with this 153. For example, it said that this is the exact number of persons that Jesus personally healed. So you can take that and consider it if you want to. This number is divisible equally by the number 51, which is also divisibly equally by the number 17, both in thirds. The number 3 speaks to the resurrection, which 5 of the 8 signs we've considered speaks to. In an earlier fishing account in Luke 5, verse 6, we're told that the net broke. You might recall that. So here John specifically stated that the net did not break. The net did not break. So this is a most encouraging thought, in that the 153 antitypical fish caught in this net are all of the redeemed, all who are approved by Jesus, none being lost. In the Luke account, the broken net suggests that some had slipped away only to return into the sea of humanity having renounced the truth. So upon arriving at shore, the disciples find that the Lord has a fire going, he's got fish cooking, he's got everything under control. The obvious lesson is that through him, their needs will be met, as we might conclude, right down to their and our need of food. I like this overhead. So, this was a model then of fellowship, both now and in the kingdom. The Son of God had sat down to a meal shared with his brethren. This was a genuine Godspeed moment. Quoting from Luke 22:29-30, "And I appoint unto you a kingdom, as my Father hath appointed unto me, that you may eat and drink at my table in the kingdom." So this reminds us, does it not, of the kindness of David that he sought to show to Saul's little lame son, Mephibosheth. Recall that account. The lame son of Mephibosheth was invited to eat at David's table continually. Jesus said in verse 12, "Come and dine." Dine means to take of a principal meal. The figure is that we dine on Christ daily, don't we? Anytime we sit down and open our Bibles, we have a principal meal. But we look forward to the intense fellowship that will be enjoyed in the kingdom. Fellowship with brethren of like precious faith is many-tiered. Sharing a simple meal together. Taking of the emblems, of course. The marriage supper of the Lamb. Eating with the prince in the east gate of Ezekiel's great temple in Ezekiel 44. This was a quiet meal. No other comments or conversation is recorded about it. Everybody was in a reflective mood. The disciples were left to reflect upon the events that had just happened. They were left to reflect upon Psalm 127. "Except Yahweh build the house, they labor in vain that build it." Any human effort to the glory of God must first seek his blessing and guidance to bring it to fruition. Human effort and toil would prove unproductive, as these fishermen had learned. So this eighth sign or miracle ends with John in verse 14 reminding us that this was the third time that Jesus showed himself to his disciples after he was risen. But we have a little more. Chapter 21 ends with the issue that Jesus wanted to discuss with Peter. You can imagine the unrest that Peter would have felt all during this time. This emotional cloud was hanging over Peter all day and all through the night, we might conclude, and during the meal together. Jesus knew that Peter was aching over his denials and to the extent that he up and went fishing. Now he had to be wondering what was in his standing, what was in the Lord's mind regarding his standing, his position with the rest of the disciples. So Peter sat in silence and he warmed himself before the coals. Now that's another little tidbit. Before the coals. We find that reference of the coals back in John 18, verse 18. That's the only other place that phrase, the fire of coals, is used in the gospel. What's John trying to tell us? He's trying to take us back to the three denials of Peter. And it was put in there to remind Peter of his three denials as well. John discreetly made this connect for us and certainly for Peter later on. In verse 15, then, Jesus begins. So when they had dined, Jesus saith to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, lovest thou me, or agape me, more than these? He saith unto him, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee, I filio thee. He saith unto him, Feed my lambs. So this then is the conversion of Peter again, I submit. This is a gentle questioning of Peter's sincerity by his master. In verse 17, Jesus asked Peter again. Actually, he had asked him a second time using the word agape, to which Peter responds, Yea, Lord, I filio thee. The difference between these two renderings of love, as I'm sure you're all familiar with, agape love is a divine love. It's unique. It's not a humanly contrived love. It's from heaven. It's the giving of God's only begotten Son because He so loved the world. It's a love that desires one's salvation. It's a love that people die for. And it's also a love that, of course, melts away into filial love. But that was the intense love that Jesus asked John up front. Lovest thou me, Peter, with this kind of intensity? Peter would have been embarrassed. He would have been frustrated and ashamed. And he couldn't answer with that same word. He says, I filio thee. Yea, Lord, I have a strong affection for thee. I love thee very much. But it wasn't with the intensity of the first usage. So then he said, feed my sheep. So Peter was beginning to know that he had been forgiven and that his value was reaffirmed. He was still in the pipeline to serve Christ. Feed my sheep. Now in verse 18 is a statement by Christ to the success and commitment of Peter as he now would succeed and triumph over the flock. So remaining faithful all of his life and that he would eventually die, Peter's death was forecast here. He would eventually die with the capacity to manifest agape love, which was the deep, dark depth of that type of love that Jesus was probing. And it's the same type of love that the various brethren and the protesters throughout the Middle Ages had to muster up and died in. So, I submit then that this is the conversion of Peter. Now back in verse 7, John injects that Peter was naked. We know that nakedness represents uncovered sin. And this is a further clue that Peter was emotionally conflicted, sin-laden at this time, and was in need of conversion. Now let's turn up Luke 22 for just a second. Luke 22, verse 31 to 32. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. This is a clue that he knew that Peter was wrestling with a number of things. We're not sure what they all were. It may have been a little disbelief at this time. It may have been a little envy. It may have been a little jealousy of his other disciples. as soon they were going to be debating which one would be the greatest in the kingdom and so forth. But anyway, Peter was clearly conflicted. But I have prayed for thee that thy faith fail not, and when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren. So he is going to be converted in this process, in this give and take with his Lord. And once he has turned, which is what converted means, once he has turned, then he would be of valuable service, feeding the lambs and the sheep. Now, Jesus knew Peter's heart. This word converted means to come again, to turn about again. And a little word there of much interest, I think, is the word again. Peter would have been in covenant. We all are upon our baptism. But I believe we may cycle through a converted and dedication of the heart a number of times in our sojourn. The storms of life can batter us. One can drift. One can sin. One can need to turn again to be converted. Peter was converted again that night on the Sea of Galilee with Jesus. And this was a fitting ending then for the Gospel of John, that none should be lost. So exercise yourself with this thought if you want to reflect upon it. And what if at the Bema, Christ only asks you one question? Lovest thou me? And see how you'd answer it. Now, I want to close in John 20, and I'll read verse 30 to 31. I'm a little ahead of myself. I'll just read for the record this last slide. Peter was naked while fishing, suggesting uncovered sin at that time. His conversion again suggests a recommitment to Christ. Jesus knows who are in the gospel net not to be lost. Here's the numeric I prefer for the 153. You take 1 plus 5 plus 3, it equals 9. 9 is the number of finality and judgment. So a little paragraph that we put together, tying all of these 8 signs in together. 153 fish will drink of the new wine, will be healed of their lameness and blindness, will feed on the bread from heaven, will weather the storms of life, will be resurrected from their sleep, and will dine with the Lord by a sea of glass. So now the verse that I want to read in John 20, beginning with the verse 30. And many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. Thank you.